Thanks all for coming. And there were a number of articles in the different journals for which we review this time around, and some of them had promising titles, but I elected not to include them because once one got into the substance of the article, I don't feel that it was necessarily relevant for our practice. So a relatively small number of articles for review this time, but I think of the ones that I selected maybe of the highest yield for our purposes here. So with that being said, wanted to start off with a topic that we all know and love, which is spread through airspaces. I know everybody cannot get enough of it, but this study takes on a slightly new approach to STAS and really gets behind fighting about what is or is not STAS and looks at how people are actually interpreting STAS. So this was conducted with colleagues at Columbia and at Mass General, and they looked at STAS in terms of illustrations rather than actual histologic images, and they asked people simply what was STAS or not, and they wanted to compare real STAS as defined by the WHO as it currently is with what the WHO defines as artifacts. And then they wanted to identify areas that were of high discrepancy to see if there could be better definitional criteria for those. And then finally, they wanted to compare how pulmonary pathologists or those interested with an interest in pulmonary pathology fared as compared to those who self-identified as general pathologists. So what happened was, these were the types of illustrations that they utilize, and this is just a sampling of the kinds of things they utilize. And I want to emphasize that the H and E's off which these drawings were based were not included in the survey. So they just utilized these pictograms depicting different features. And there were 14 questions that were asked of pathologists. Most of these pathologists, my understanding is, were people who attended a thoracic pathology course. So there were both pulmonary pathologists and general pathologists attending this course. And they ended up getting 136 participants. Six of those were trainees, so 130 practicing pathologists. And what they tried to do with this survey was depict what the authors felt was bona fide STAS based on the WHO criteria and things that they felt were artifact. So they depicted, for example, in the A figure, these rounded collections of tumor that goes beyond the borders of the tumor. And then a B, of course, it looks like micropapillary clusters of tumor that are beyond the confines of the tumor itself. And then what they were going for in cases like C were not that it was kind of tightly distributed, but more randomly distributed, and what people categorize that as. And then they had other issues. They also wanted to look at, well, depending on the purple on the side is the tumor edge. And so they also wanted to look at, well, how close to the tumor are these clusters when people do or do not call STAS? And then they also looked at, they tried to examine things that they felt depicted what the WHO would say were artifact. So for example, in illustration E, it's a cluster that has these irregular edges, and they were trying to get people to go for that was artifact. And then in F, what they're also depicting, in addition to these micropapillary clusters of tumor, are strips of ciliated bronchial epithelium that they wanted to Have people say, of course, we're not STAS, but can happen. So here's what happened when they looked at people demographically. 70% of them were individuals who practiced pulmonary pathology, and 65% were in an academic setting. And histologic agreement for STAT for recognizing solid patterns of tumor, such as depicted here, was very high, as it was for micropapillary clusters of tumor that were greater, equal to, or greater than 3 alveolar spaces from the main tumor mass. So in this number three part, this distance from the main tumor mass, people had very high inter-observer agreement in terms of that. But what happened was the closer the distance of the clusters to the tumor, the less agreement that people had that that was in fact STAS. And then they looked at things like distribution of tumor, and it didn't seem to matter much whether it was a more random distribution or a more I don't want to say cohesive, but clustered distribution of the clusters. People were fairly good at recognizing things as artifact, at least depicted here by these jagged lines. And as far as picking up on the artifacts, or not necessarily artifacts, but benign findings, if it was just respiratory epithelium with no associated tumor clusters, people were good at recognizing that as such, as not STAS. Things got murkier when there was a combination of both detached respiratory strips and tumor as well. So for classic patterns, or what one would consider classic patterns of STAS, the inter-observer or overall agreement was good. And they considered these types of things as classic patterns of STAS, and it was about 80% overall agreement. But then, as you can see, there was areas of there was struggling. As I mentioned, these tumor cell clusters close to the tumor, fair agreement for recognizing artifacts, and there wasn't, it seemed like there wasn't enough statistical power to say a lot about when respiratory epithelium was mixed with true STAS. So there certainly are some limitations of this study. The fact that they used illustrations rather than H&Es, I think, is something one needs to think about. And would things be would the results be different if they'd used actual H&Es or not? I have to wonder about that. It seems, especially for me, looking at this figure F where the cilia are apparent, it seems like they might not be as easily identified on H&E. So I have to wonder about the veracity of illustrations as compared to real life. The argument that the authors make was that it was easier for for participants to access these images rather than larger files that would have H&Es. They also made some other arguments. But at the end of the day, I think that the study provided some useful areas where the WHO could provide greater clarity for STAS. And one of those is really what the minimum number of tumor cell clusters is needed for STAS. So they highlighted the issue of, is it just one cluster? Do you need more than one cluster? That should be better defined. The second issue was whether this panel 1G, where there's cluster right next to the main tumor edge, really is STAS or not. So the WHO currently is pretty vague on that. And so the authors suggested that they really need to better define that, whether right next to this tumor edge is sufficient or it needs to be some number of alveolar spaces away. The third thing that they recognized is that there are these cases where there's co-occurrence of either artifact and stasis or these detached respiratory epithelial cells and stasis. And that seems to pose a challenge for people. And it should be emphasized that those things can co-occur. And just because there is artifact or just because there are detached respiratory epithelial strips, one shouldn't automatically say no stas and still look carefully for stas in those cases. So yes, yet another article on stas, but I think it does point to some things that the WHO could do better or make more strict or more apparent in a future edition. And just know that you're not alone when you struggle with is this stas or not? And hopefully in the future, we'll get some better guidance on that. So that is that article. I found that use of illustrations mildly interesting. Any questions or thoughts about how this struck people?
Thanks, Kelly. Was there better concordance among, and maybe you said it and I missed it. I was trying to look at the pictures. Better
Yeah.
concordance among pulmonary pathologists than there was between pulmonary pathologists and general pathologists? Or
And
didn't they break?
I actually didn't say that, but that is a question that I should have answered. And the agreement did not significantly differ between them, actually, at
I don't know
least
if
in
that's a
the.
good or a bad thing, but maybe that's a good thing.
Yeah, right. One also has to wonder if most of the study population respondents were taking, I'd have to look back and see how many respondents were taking this CME course that prompted them to do this study. But you got to wonder if, even if they say they're general pathologists, they obviously have a motivated interest in doing pulmonary pathology. So I'm not quite sure it was, people who maybe see a resection periodically as opposed to maybe a general pathology group's kind of go-to person for pulmonary pathology, but nonetheless.
Well, and in the end, I think, I mean, outside of an academic institution, most of these will be signed out by general pathologists. So, I mean, we should strive for some agreement here. You know, I was wondering about that. So, thanks for presenting that. Quite interesting about figure G2. So, if I'm remembering right, according to the WHO, stas is considered if it's one alveolar space away from the tumor edge. So I'm surprised that G2 has not the consensus as G3 has.
Yeah, right. Look, it G2, it looks like 73% felt that that was stas. So certainly not as good as, it's crazy. It's crazy going from the next alveolar space to the next alveolar space to the next alveolar space. It seems to be this sweet spot for people of feeling good about it or not. But yes, they definitely pointed out that perhaps the WHO should make a more strict or make it more evident what the number of spaces is. Seems like, however, the language is in there right now just doesn't seem to stick for people.
Yeah, maybe it would be good to have like a picture library so people can just compare
Right?
whatever. I mean,
No, I know. I couldn't agree with you more. I am still kind of fascinated with figure F, and I bet if you showed an actual H and E to people, the amount of people that would have actually called stas would have been really low. Although maybe it would be mixed and people would overinterpret it. I'm not sure. It would be interesting. All right. Well, if there aren't any more questions about that one, I'll move on to the next one. And the next one takes us in a completely different direction. And tell me if if you're seeing the next article or if I need to get out of the share and
restart. No, you're good. You're good.
Yeah, you're good.
Oh, good. You'd think years of Zoom, I'd figure this out. But anyway, so switching gears entirely now. This next article, although a very simple premise, really gets to a data set that hasn't really been looked at carefully in a while. And that's really what the heck is the significance of seeing thrombi in resection specimens? And so this is out of the group in Boston. And most studies that have looked at thrombi or thromboemboli in lung specimens have been autopsy series. And there really have not been a lot of studies looking at resections from living patients. So what this group attempted to do was look at surgical resection specimens and find the frequency with which thrombi were seen. And then they attempted to correlate what the histologic features of those thrombi are, and I'll go through those in a moment, with whether the patients who had those had clinically significant evidence of thromboembolic disease, and then what the impact on clinical management was for these patients. So I'll just take you through the kinds of thromboemboli that they were looking for. This was a study that was at a single academic medical center, and they looked at all cases of resections, whether they be from neoplastic or non-neoplastic, for a several-year period in which thrombi or thromboemboli were reported, and they retrospectively reviewed them. And they looked at a number of characteristics. And so they looked at whether they characterized whether the thrombi were acute. We all know from way back when what that looks like. They characterized whether they were early organizing, as one can see here. And then they also looked at whether they had sequelae of late or features that looked like late thrombi, or these webs that suggest really remote thrombi. And they characterized those, and they even got more granular looking at each of these, whether there was a combination or just one pattern and things of that nature. They also looked at how many thrombi there were by volume. And what they did was they looked at the number of thrombi, divide that by the number of slides that contained non-tumorous lung parenchyma, and they came up with a volumetric measurement. Additionally, they looked at how big the vessels were that had these thrombi. Were they small vessels? Were they really big vessels? Additionally, for cases that had tumor nearby, they looked at where the thrombi were in relation to the tumor. Were they close by? Were they distant from the tumor? And they additionally looked at were there hypertensive changes in the background? So they looked at 2,930 resections. Well, they didn't look at them all, but they did a data dive on those. And what they found was that 66, or about 2.3%, had these pulmonary thrombotic arteriopathy changes. Here's the demographics. There was a slight female predominance. And then the upper lobe was the most common lobe to have thromboemboli. But the issue was also that the upper lobe was the most commonly resected lobe as well. So it's hard to sort out what the significance, if any, of that was. Most of the time, the resections were for cancer, and then the rest were for ILD and then other various causes. What else did they have? None of the patients of these 66 were known to have some sort of pre-existing hypercoagulable state. But there was a history of pulmonary hypertension, which, let's see if they show this here, was present in 9%. I don't think they have a separate table for that. All right. So going to actually what they found was in these 66 cases, the average number of thrombi were 15. And then most of the cases showed a variety of thrombi ranging from early organizing, and then later stages. Most of the cases only involved small to medium-sized arteries, and large artery involvement was actually much less common. Let's see what they have here. Yeah, so it gets in the weeds of breaking down whether they had clinically recognized disease or just straight up these findings were present. So of the 66 cases, about 20 had large artery involvement, but if we look at what the clinical pathologic issues are, which we'll do in a second, that sorts out a little bit more interestingly. So about half of cases actually also showed infarct, and half also showed, not the same ones, but a half of all comers showed hypertensive changes. Of patients who had tumor in their resection, most of the time the thromboemboli were away from the tumor. And then we get into, well, of all these patients who had these findings, did they have clinically recognized thromboembolic disease? And we can see the data here, but just to summarize the data, about 36% had clinically recognized disease, either preceding or subsequent to things. And a significant proportion of these patients had thromboemboli of varying ages. And then the key was that they often had large artery involvement. So what happened to these patients to figure out whether they had thromboembolic disease that was significant or not? So of the ones who had no known prior disease, and the thromboembolic disease or thromboemboli were noted in the pathology report, there were 46 of those, but only 6 went on to have further workup. And then of those, 2 were confirmed to have thromboembolic disease, either through additional imaging or additional clinical pathologic or clinical radiologic studies. Another 2 that didn't receive any workup out of those actually went on to develop subsequent pulmonary emboli. So even though it's a small number, the authors argue that of all resections that are all comers, about 2% have thromboembolic disease found in them. And they 2/3 don't have any clinical suspicion of thromboembolic disease. But the key thing is that only a very small percentage, even in which it's mentioned, end up going on to have workup, and it can be clinically significant for these patients. So what the authors argue is that it's important to mention thrombi in your section specimens, and they really emphasize that especially in patients who have large artery involvement, are likely to have clinically significant disease. And perhaps we should press a little bit further in those patients to maybe word our comment more strongly to suggest that additional clinical investigations be taken. So I thought this was, you know, a meat and potatoes kind of study that hasn't been done in surgical resections in a while, and has some important points that we can guide the clinician's hand in these and not necessarily just bury the thromboemboli in a comment. I'd be interested in other people's thoughts about this and what they do currently if they find these in their resection specimens.
Well, obviously, this is right up my bailiwick here. And
Sure,
so
awesome. Fine.
I always, looking at the vessels are kind of my favorite thing to do. So I look at the vessels at every resection specimen. I always comment when I see these, and kind of just like they do, I stratify them by their acuity, just like they've done. So Bobby Padera and I kind of have a similar approach to this, and he's included as an author here. And so he's the one of the cardiac pathologists at the Brigham. And so it's the same approach that we take with basically systemic arteries as well. So yeah, I always call it out. And then when I do, I also look really carefully for other features of pulmonary arterial hypertension. And I quantify those as best I can. And those would include things like intimal fibroplasia, medial hypertrophy, muscularization of the pulmonary arterioles, those types of things. And I kind of go out and quantify those to the best of my ability as well. And then, indicate whether or not I believe that those hypertensive changes are possibly related to the thrombosis that's being seen there. And so which is not always possible, of course, but I try to give the best direction that I can. But I do think that this is important, and I agree with him. I do think that this is underrecognized, and I, for one, am really happy to see that they actually went through and did this, which I think is long overdue.
Excellent. Thanks for those comments. Anybody else?
Yeah, this has been on my radar. I'm sorry to see somebody else did it first, but you can only do so much.
Yeah.
We see them all the time in, ILD cases. I mean, I see less lung cancer cases. And it's like sending your kids off to college. You never hear back from them unless there's a problem. And these college children never have a problem because I never hear from anybody that, oh, thank you. We worked the patient up and they've got a factor five Leiden deficiency or whatever. But I always mention it just like Joe. And I sort of, have the same, recent organizing, right? Depending. So sort of a similar way of categorizing them. I probably pay less attention to whether I see pulmonary hypertensive kinds of changes in the background, but I'll usually say something like, concentric and eccentric intimal thickening most consistent with heel thrombi, parentheses, question mark thromboemboli, and in the note say, a prior event may be known, but if not, a workup for a peripheral source or an underlying coagulopathy may be indicated. And that's kind of my standard blurb.
I love it. Yeah. We can, I'm going to lift that right off the recording
You
for
may.
my
I mean, I say
patients.
it a lot. That's how come
Yeah.
it just like flows off my tongues, because it's so common.
Yeah. Yeah.
Trademark Tazalar.
Thank you. It'll be
Exactly.
the only thing I trademark, but anyway.
I agree. I agree, Henry, with these things far more commonly being seen in the setting of ILD, it seems. But I would make one caveat to that, and I think this is actually a ripe area for study if there's somebody that has bandwidth that wants to pursue this. I think it would be really helpful. There's a lot of growing scuttle, particularly in the cardiovascular kind of domains and the cardio-oncology domains, about seeing increased thrombotic events in the setting of immune checkpoint inhibitors. And so I do think that for individuals who undergo resections for kind of either failed or incomplete response to ICI therapy, that we might actually see kind of more of this phenomenon in there than we would, kind of in the non-ICI setting, which I think would be really interesting data to add to this field right now, which I think is just starting to kind of grow and expand this idea of increased thrombosis in the setting of ICI. Because, unfortunately, every single patient that has an immune checkpoint inhibitor, they come in and at the drop of a hat, with even any mild drop in cardiac function or anything, they're given, massive doses of steroids and a whole host of other things that have really significant complications. And they oftentimes really anticoagulate them and the like. And we don't really know if it's necessary or not, but I do think that, we should be looking more closely at this and trying to study it more deliberately.
Great. Great discussion on that paper. Thank you. All right. So I wanted to include something from one of our own members here. And Jen Bolin was the senior author on a study of looking at retrospectively at thoracic mass lesions in the pediatric population. This is a Herculean dive into the last 25 years of patients who've had resections who are age 21 or less at the Mayo Clinic. And for cases that were neoplastic, those that had adequate tissue were subjected to molecular testing. What they found was that there were, over those 25 years, were 385 thoracic mass lesions in the pediatric patients that were resected, and they came from 373 individuals. So there were several individuals who had multiple lesions resected, either at the same time or at different times. As one might expect, there were a higher number of non-neoplastic lesions resected as compared to neoplastic lesions. So the ratio there was almost 6 to 1, non-neoplastic to neoplastic. In terms of the ratio, and then we'll skip back and forth here in a second, but in the corollary, in looking at tumors, the ratio actually was not actually all that different between, excuse me, I should say the ratio of metastatic tumors to primary mediastinal or lung tumors was also almost about 6 to 1. So overall, non-neoplastic was most common, and then of neoplastic, metastases were much more common than primary lung tumors. So in terms of the non-neoplastic cases, they divided things into things that were lesions, cysts, and malformations were most common, and they were seen in about, altogether were seen in about 46% of patients with non-neoplastic lesions. And most of these were detected because the patient actually had some non-thoracic prior malignancy under which they were being surveyed periodically. It's not surprising that most patients with cysts and malformations were younger than the other patients. Their median age was 8 months. And then the most common cysts and malformations, of course, were CPAMs, which are down here, and bronchial atresia and sequestrations. And then regarding non-malformations and cysts, the most common situation encountered was necrotizing granulomas. And most of these actually were found, it was able to be determined that they had an infectious etiology. With regard to neoplastic lesions, metastases were again the most common, about 45% of patients. And then within that, osteosarcoma was most common, followed by Ewing sarcoma. Only about 6% of patients had a primary lung tumor, and then 4% were determined to have a primary extrapulmonary thoracic neoplasm. And the median age between patients who had metastases and primary mediastinal neoplasms didn't differ. As far as primary lung tumors, let's see if they have this separately. Yeah, here we go. So the most common tumor was carcinoid. 3 of 10 of those were atypical carcinoids, and most of those were endobronchial. And two of the patients who had a prior history of malignancy, but they didn't have any known underlying tumor-causing genetic syndrome, actually had small lung adenocarcinomas. Here and here. And so they tried to look at those patients a little bit further. And what happened was, these primary lung tumors mostly were microsatellite stable. They had a low mutational burden. And some of the carcinoids had molecular alterations that were similar to those seen in adults, But others had some interesting findings, including, and I'm not a molecular pathologist, but distinct copy number alterations. I don't recollect that the small adenocarcinomas had any type of targetable mutation, although now I am not necessarily recollecting that. I may not exactly be recollecting that correctly, but I don't believe that was the case. But they didn't have BAP or some other type of underlying syndrome that was found. So in sum, thoracic mass lesions, when you're presenting them with them, especially at frozen or in terms of thinking about grossing them or triaging the specimen when it comes to the bench, really you should think about non-neoplastic lesions first, especially if they're cystic, the usual types of pediatric thoracic entities, congenital cysts, malformations, but also importantly, granulomas. And perhaps if even if it is cystic, if there's any whiff that it could be necrotic, perhaps you want to set aside some tissue for culture in terms of that. And then and then secondly, if it looks neoplastic, think first about metastases rather than primary thoracic neoplasm. All right. So a nice, super comprehensive study. Just to get us in the framework of what are the most likely differential diagnoses in this age range. Any questions about this one?
So when did they change the age of what it was to be a child?
Yeah, I was
I mean,
surprised if
21, right? I mean, and you know, a lot of the carcinoids were in older patients, you know, in the patients between 18 and 21. So I'm just surprised that they didn't pick the classic eight, you know, age of 18.
Yeah.
It's too bad Jen isn't on, but
Because
like, why that number?
nobody leaves the house anymore before
Right,
21.
exactly.
Well, I know, but you know, they mature way earlier, so you know.
Yeah. I
Well,
know.
women, not
Yeah.
men.
21's the new, if
Dirty
21's the
joke.
new 18, then, 55 is the new, we could extrapolate, but
Yeah.
I actually believe our pediatric pathologist keeps emphasizing to us the age 21 as well. So I am almost thinking that from a COG perspective, that they've defined it in that way. But I more than that, I really don't know. If anyone else has any insights into that, I just don't know.
Yeah, I feel like our pediatric pathologist takes stuff a little bit beyond 18 a
Yes.
lot of the time.
All right. So I just wanted
They
to
define it? I don't know. I don't know. I don't think most 21-year-olds would consider themselves children, but anyway.
Yeah.
They can vote for, I mean, they can vote at 18, so you're
They
not a
can go to
child.
war.
Yeah, right. Anyway, and I mean, you're not, you don't have to defend their decision. I was just curious if somebody knew something about definitional changes.
Yeah, I think it's a definitional thing with COG or something like that.
Okay.
All right. Good deal. So, the last article that I wanted to discuss today is it's an article that took a couple tries to get through. And I'll try to summarize it as best I can. And for those of you who know some of the authors, perhaps a senior author, that may not be surprising in terms of trying to wrap one's head around this. But the basic issue that was looked at was when a resected lung adenocarcinoma is taken from the patient, there's iatrogenic collapse, either after it's removed or even while it's I guess iatrogenic is what they're going for in terms of something we did or failed to do to the specimen, and that creates all sorts of problems in terms of trying to classify well-differentiated adenocarcinomas. Are they in situ? Are they invasive? Do they look pseudo-invasive because of collapse or what have you? So that was kind of the underlying issue here, and could it be sorted out? So a lot went into the study. A lot of thought went into it, and I would just point you out, I was not able to put the supplemental stuff in as a document because it's just online. But I urge you to check out the online supplement document in on it. It has grapes that have been shriveled, and they liken that to iatrogenic collapse. So there's a lot of thought about trying to understand iatrogenic collapse in these cases. But what the study authors did for this was they found a cohort of 70 cases. There were two institutions submitting an equal number of resected lung adenocarcinomas that were 3 centimeters or less. And they looked at a whole variety of features. They looked at, let's see, there's the demographics. I don't think they have a table of what they actually looked at, but they looked at the quantity of tumor cells and stroma, how much air there was, and even the tumor cell height and length. They did keratin stains and EVG stains on these cases, and they even developed a mathematical model to simulate collapse. The end of the day, what happened was of these 70 cases, one had been classified originally as AIS. And when they were re-reviewed, an additional 9 cases became reclassified as AIS with iatrogenic collapse. All of those cases that were ultimately classified as AIS had 100% recurrence-free survival. And I think the takeaways, without getting too deep into the results of the study, are that what they wanted to do was propose some helpful nomenclature when there are these gray zone cases. You can see in cases like this where they argue that the elastin stain still has the features of an alveolar architectural framework, so it represents iatrogenic collapse. But what they wanted to highlight are what the heck to do with these cases where there still looks to be an elastic framework, but clearly there's a solid growth pattern. So it's not so much the architectural collapse, but accounting for these other patterns. And they talk about this case as a gray zone case where it's a bit uncertain whether there is actually architectural disruption or not. But I think the most helpful features for this particular study are looking at kind of the language that they use for handling some of these cases, which they talk about alveolar filling growth, as opposed to is the architectural framework disrupted or not. I think at the end of the day, I think what they're hoping for is that in a future WHO, there will be more language to make things less gray zone in terms of what one calls invasion or not. But again, I think what I was left with from this case is that just be aware that these papillary structures could be iatrogenic collapse and really be pseudopapillae or pseudoacini, and try your best to use elastin stains to think about that before you just call something invasive papillary or acinar carcinoma. But really what I was left with, and I know we're coming in close to time, is that I really do feel, and I'd be really interested in other people's opinions, is that if something is this complicated, and patients who have minimally invasive lung cancer or AIS have greater than a 95% recurrence-free survival at 5 years. I understand there's a little bit of distinction there in terms of prognosis, but are we splitting so much that we may land on the wrong side of lumping? I'd be curious of others' thoughts. And if they have none, that's totally okay.
Oh, I think Henry's.
Yeah, sorry. I like to use elastic stains. I'm going to have to run here to another meeting, but
Of course.
my colleagues don't like to use them. I think I have a lower, I've heard Noguchi talk, and I guess I have a lower threshold or a higher threshold for calling invasion. I allow a little bit of thickness in my alveolar walls for it still to be AIS, but I think some of my colleagues automatically call those papillary. And, you know, we have an internal review process for cases, and we review each other's cases as part of a quality program. And, you know, I usually don't quibble about, you know, how somebody's classifying it, but it's clear that we've got a spectrum within our own group. So anyway, I got to run. Thanks very much. Great
Yeah,
discussion.
thank you. All right. Thanks everybody for attending. Happy holidays to all, and we'll see you in the new year.
All right, bye
You too.
everyone.
Thank you very much.
Yeah,
Thank
thank you.
you. Bye.